The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One. All right, legendary rock photographer Bob Gruen went to Japan with Kiss, used to watch TV at the Dakota with one of his best friends, John Lennon, stayed up all night on many different nights with Joe Strummer of The Clash, and played a small role in both the New York Dolls' rise to fame and the Sex Pistols lineup. He's hanging out with Green Day these days, and he's hanging out with Chris Jericho. Bob's got rock and roll stories like you wouldn't believe, and has shot some of the most iconic photos in the history of rock and roll. You know that John Lennon New York City, where John Lennon's wearing the New York City t-shirt? You know that one? Bob took that picture. He's telling all of these stories right here on Talk is Jericho. If you like rock and roll, if you like art, if you like photography, if you like great stories about great guys, famous, iconic, legendary, super, super, super famous guys, you're going to love Bob Gruen's story. But before we talk about Bob, let me say thanks to all of you, the Talk is Jericho fans, for listening twice a week every week and for supporting our great Talk is Jericho sponsors who make this possible for me to do this for you for free. And that includes Diamond Dallas Page and DDP Yoga. He's giving you guys, once again, a great deal to you sexy beasts on DDP Yoga at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Now, if you take advantage of this deal, you'll also get hooked up with 3 free months of the new DDP Yoga Now app. All right. When I'm finished doing this introduction, I'm going to do yoga on the app, on my phone. It is so, so revolutionary. The app is tremendous. I gave it a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you go download it, you'll see I'm not the only one giving it such great ratings. DDP has an Android version of the app as well, or you can get it at the Google Play Store. And the best thing about the app is that I can get all the workouts right on my phone. Very accessible. I don't have to lug around DVDs or a DVD player. I just do everything on the phone on the app. And the app even has live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center. It's got recipes, nutrition guides. You can watch live cooking shows. You can earn rewards within the app and redeem them for some cool prizes and DDP Yoga merch. You guys know how it works, man. The more yoga you do, the more points you get. The more points you get, the more free stuff you get. Now, that's what DDP Yoga is willing to do for you. And listen, you know what DDP Yoga has done for me. You know what DDP Yoga has done for thousands of others around the world. I believe in this program. I stand behind this program. And that's why you hear me talk about it so much. It's also why Dallas has given all of you a great deal. The sexy beast listeners of Talk is Jericho. You're going to get the best price on DDP Yoga at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Then if you purchase DDP Yoga at ddpyoga.com/Jericho, you'll get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. 3 free months. Okay, that's free. 3 months. You heard me right. Get started on DDP Yoga today. It's one of the best decisions you can make for your health, for your mental state of mind, for your peace of mind. It will change your life for the better. And you can do it now, and you can take advantage of the special offer and get the lowest price for DDP Yoga and 3 free months of access to the unbelievable DDP Yoga Now app. You're going to go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho, and you're going to do it now. Change your life. Get started today. Get in the best shape you've ever been in at ddpyoga.com/Jericho.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Okay, so this is kind of almost part of rock and roll history here in Bob Gruen's studio, photography studio slash home slash iconic place where most rockers have hung out over the years. Because, Bob, you are probably the most famous rock photographer of all time.
I'm getting pretty well known, that's for sure.
You know what I mean? Yeah, because, I mean, you think of certain photographers, but you have... I mean, so many iconic images that people probably don't even realize that you've taken, that all of them have been taken by the same guy.
Well, that's the interesting thing about my book, Rock Scene, spelled S-E-E-N, like the things I've seen.
Yeah.
When it came out, and it's out now, so many people look through it and they don't realize that the guy who took the John Lennon picture also took the Led Zeppelin picture, also took the Clash picture and Sex Pistols and Debbie Harry and...
Dressed to Kill album cover.
And Dressed to Kill, yeah. You know, Kiss cover. I also took the pictures when Kiss made their comic book. I took the pictures of them pouring the blood in the
ink. No kidding.
All kinds of things I've done that, you know, people don't realize the same person was getting around.
How did you become, just briefly, you know, to get into the position where you're meeting up with all these guys and taking all these pictures?
Well, one thing always led to another. I mean, it's interesting how I got involved with Kiss. It was actually when I was working with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. They were recording at the record plant, and Bill O'Coin and Joyce Biowitz had a TV show out of Chicago, and they came to New York to record record company presidents with their favorite artists. And so, of course, John Lennon, as president of Apple, his favorite artist was Yoko. and so they were recording John and Yoko in the studio, and that's the first time I met Bill O'Coin. And then he also worked with Neil Bogart at
Head of Casablanca Records,
as part of his TV show. And they did a number of people. And then when he met Kiss, he brought them to Neil at Buddha Records. And I was already doing a lot of work with Buddha Records. And it was kind of a natural fit since I was working with Buddha Records pretty normally. And I already knew Bill and Joyce. So when they started managing Kiss, they came to me and... you know, asked me to take the pictures. Actually, one of the first pictures I did was when they signed the contract with Neil Bogart. There's a picture Neil put on makeup, and he actually handcuffed himself to the contract to make it a little more dramatic. And we took that picture actually in the alleyway at the Academy of Music. It was a New Year's Eve. I think it was 1973, maybe. Maybe 72. Anyway, yeah, it was early on New Year's Eve when Iggy Pop was playing and Kiss was the opening act here on 14th Street in New York at the Academy of Music. And I remember taking pictures of the show. It was the first time I ever saw them. They were wild, and it was kind of a crazy night. Gene had some new pyrotechnics because they had a little budget from the record company. So he had bought these kind of fireballs that you kind of squeeze it or somehow and it lights and then you throw it right away, or you throw it and then it lights in the air. And he threw the first one a little too late and it hit somebody in the face and actually burned the guy a little bit. And it was funny because he came backstage. He didn't want to leave the show. They wanted to take him in an ambulance to treat his burn, and he loved Kiss so much, and he didn't blame them at all. He was happy to be part of the show, practically.
You know what's funny? I had Gene on the show, and he told that exact same story.
Yeah, it was wild.
Except the addition was he said they had the guy sign something. Oh, we love you so much. Just sign here, kid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they didn't want to sue him later.
That's right.
But I do remember that the kid was such a fan, he had no intention of suing. He was... happy to be part of it.
The show.
So the next one, Gene held it back a little too long, and it caught his hair on fire. And I remember their roadie, Sean, come running out and put a towel over Gene's head and put the fire out. An interesting thing for me was that I was used to taking pictures before a show when the band is getting ready. Certainly with Kiss, we always did that. When they put the makeup on, we'd have to take a bunch of pictures. And then during the show, and then after the show, usually whatever celebrities are at the show would come back to talk to the band. And I would part of my job was take pictures of all of that and the after party or whatever. And so I got to the dressing room that first night, and Bill was standing there. He goes, "No, Bob, there's no pictures after the show. There's no pictures of Kiss without the makeup." And I was like, "Really?" He goes, "Yes, they're only Kiss with makeup on. There will be no pictures without makeup."
Wow.
And I was like, "I'm free. I can go home." And I did. I remember coming and
leaving. Easy to work, right?
And and so from then on, it was easy and it was hard. I mean, I didn't have to spend the whole night taking pictures, but we had to do a whole night and a whole day and a whole week's worth of pictures in the 10 minutes before they went on stage.
I see.
Because each guy would actually put on their own makeup, which took a while because it's pretty elaborate and they did it very carefully. And then once the makeup was on, then they would kiss and then I could take pictures. And that only lasted about 10 or 15 minutes before they went on stage. So we had to have pictures of them sitting around, having a drink, talking to people, doing whatever they, you know, do to make it look like they were always Kiss. Especially when we went to Japan, we went over there and, you know, they were flying on the plane like normal people. And then half hour before we landed, they got up and they put on their makeup. And then we had to take a series of pictures of them sitting in the seats, talking to stewardesses, walking around the airplane as if they had been Kiss for the entire flight. Right? You know? And that was funny because they came off. They wanted to arrive in Japan as Kiss, of course. And they came off the plane and there was probably 200, you know, photographers. They have a lot of magazines and photographers in Japan. So all these people were taking pictures when they arrived. The customs agents refused to pass them with their makeup on. And it was a great, you know, press coup for them that they were not themselves when they had the makeup on. Right. That the customs agents couldn't be sure if it was really Gene Simmons or, you know, Paul Stanley.
Looking at the passport pictures.
And I remember Bill had tried to get an alternate passport photo, the way some people, like, you know, they have an AKA, like their real name, also known as Cary Grant or whoever, you know. And they tried to do that with, you know, here's the photo, AKA, also seen as, you know, you know, this Kiss character. And the customs guys wouldn't go for it. And they had to actually come into customs, go into a side room. They did provide a private room because they said their identities were secret. And Japan, the authorities actually went along with that, which was, again, a great press coup, that they could go into a private room, wash the makeup off, be approved that they were really themselves, put the makeup back on, and reappear to drive to the airport as Kiss. So the only times I've actually been with Kiss a couple of times when they put makeup on during the day, it's very rare that they'll do a photo session aside from actually at a show. But actually, it was in Japan. It was the first one when they, Music Life magazine wanted to do a special issue about them. And they were paying them a lot to do this special issue. It was an entire issue. Music Life was one of the biggest music magazines in the world. It had over a million circulation for a big color magazine that came out weekly.
Was it a Japanese magazine?
A Japanese magazine. There was only two like it. There was one in Germany and this one in Japan. Music Life was a big one. So they wanted to do a special issue on Kiss, and Kiss agreed to do it. They were being paid for it. Gene will agree to just about anything that he's getting paid for, you know. And but they had to prove that they were in Japan. And they didn't want just pictures in a dressing room or pictures on stage, because that could be any dressing room or any stage.
Right.
And they needed pictures showing that they were in Japan. So at the theater, we took a number of pictures of them talking to guards or talking to the promoters or other Japanese people. But they wanted to see that they were in Japan. So in Kyoto, we arranged to go outside around the city to several different Japanese shrines, famous Japanese shrines, to take pictures of them there, proving they were actually in the country. I went around the day before, and I had a cab driver, and the promoter directed the cab driver. We went to about six or eight different famous shrines, and I took Polaroids of them. And then that night we went over it with the band, and I showed them the pictures and asked them which ones they wanted to use. And we picked out three of them. And I had arranged for the same cab driver to come back the next day. So the band and a lot of press that we had with us got on the bus. I had the cab driver leading the bus, and I could just show him the Polaroid and say, take me back to this place. And then he knew which place it was because he had been there with me the day before. So we went back, and I remember the first one, there was a big Buddha statue. And as we were coming up the hill to the statue, I saw the promoter kind of rushing down the hill. And I was like, why is he leaving? We're just about to get here. I thought he was going to be helping us out with this. And we got there, and we got off the bus, and I started arranging everybody, and some people started talking Japanese to our handlers, and they're going back and forth. And I'm just telling the band, get over there, let's start, you know, get this done right away. And they're posing in front of the Buddha, and I'm taking a bunch of pictures, and the Japanese guys are saying, Bob, we got to talk to you. I said, no, I'm busy, you know, in a minute. He goes, no, we really have to talk to you. I said, I'm busy, I'm taking the pictures right now, you know. And he said, no, we really have to talk to you. I said, what? And he goes, well, this is a shrine to the dead, and we're really, like, upsetting them by using this as a background for a rock and roll band. You know, there's people here praying. And so we apologized profusely. By that time we were done, we had plenty of pictures. And we left. And that's why the promoter was running away. And then we went to another place, the Golden Pavilion. And the thing was, a lot of people who were at the first place, at the Buddha place, when we got back on the bus, they started following us. So by the time we got to the second place, there must have been 20 or 30 cars following us. And then everybody who was there when we left that place started following us. So by the time we got to the third place, we had a parade of about 70 or 80 cars following us through Kyoto, and it turned into this big madhouse. And it was like literally hundreds of people watching us by the time we got to the third place.
Was it hard? I mean, you're the official photographer, obviously. Was there a lot of people always with cameras poised trying to get pictures of those guys without their makeup on?
Well, I was very nervous. I talked to Bill O'Coin about that before we went, about how they would handle that there are so many people in Japan with cameras. I mean, nowadays everybody everywhere has a camera.
Phone, yeah.
But back then, you had to actually know how to, you know, develop film and deal with the f-stops and the, so on, the shutter speeds. But in Japan, they were very into the photography, and so there were a lot of cameras around there. And the way it was there was the band, and each one had their own roadie, and then there was a couple of more handlers, and the manager, and the publicist, and his assistant, and me, and my assistant. And we had about a dozen or more press people that they had brought along with them. So altogether, there was more than 30, probably almost 40 people in the entourage. And Kiss was just part of those people. And without the makeup, they don't look at all like Kiss. And so when you're looking at 40 foreigners, it's like pick the one that could be Kiss. Yeah, it could be anybody.
Guys, you know,
a couple of their guards were even taller than Gene, so he wasn't even the biggest guy.
Right.
So it really didn't happen. There was nobody to focus on. They had no idea who Kiss was out of the crowd that we traveled with. So that really didn't happen. There were guards around them, and sometimes I remember they were in a nightclub one time, and their guards were pretty strict about nobody taking any pictures of them without makeup, to the point where it got a little silly sometimes. And the guards were pretty aggressive about it. I remember one time when I was with the New York Dolls in New Orleans, and Kiss had played a show nearby. And in New Orleans, the Dolls played late shows, which went on at 3 and 5 a.m. That's New Orleans for you.
Right.
So Kiss came to the show after their show, and they were hanging out there, and I was taking some pictures of the band, and all of a sudden a guard grabbed me, and he's holding me up against the wall. You can't take any pictures of Gene without his makeup. I'm like, I'm not. I'm taking pictures of the band on stage. He goes, well, Gene might be in that picture. I said, well, he might or might not, and you're not taking my film. Like, don't even think of it. He's like, give me your film. I'm like, no, you're not getting my film. Like, that's not happening.
Yeah.
I said, I know Bill O'Coin. You call Bill O'Coin, tell him my name, and tell him that you tried to take my film, and see what he says. You know, I got away with it, but a lot of people were harassed by the guards quite a bit.
They would take the film and throw it away.
They would take the film and expose it. They were real, real strict about not getting any photos out. I remember one time we were at a party, and I think Gene was holding his hand over his face to kind of cover his face while I took a picture of him with the editor of the magazine. And a couple of days later, the publicist called him and says, you can't use that picture. And he said, yes, I can. Gene posed for it. You know, I'm using it. And you couldn't really see him. One of the few pictures where they didn't have makeup, but he was pretty covered up.
Yeah,
you know? I really liked the makeup. It made them very special. It made them truly a superhero character.
Absolutely.
I had a very interesting experience early on working with them when we did the Dress to Kill pictures.
Is that your idea? Whose idea was that?
It was actually an idea by the Cream Magazine art director, Charlie Oranger. I had an idea to do a comic book about Kiss. And the story was that Kiss was your average office worker on their way to work reading the newspaper, and that's why they're dressed in suits and ties. That was like a secret identity. Of course, with the makeup on, you'd never recognize them because they had a suit and tie, and they didn't
look
at all like
Superman with the glasses.
It's like Superman with his glasses,
Clark
something
Kent.
Like that.
Yeah.
Or even worse. I mean, that makeup, you can't take it off like glasses, you know. So, but anyway, we did the pictures, and the idea was that they were reading the newspaper, and they saw in the newspaper there was a concert by a guy named John Cleveland, which I think was John Denver cleverly disguised. And they were horrified that the world was so bland and that they had to save the world with rock and roll. And so they went around town putting up fake posters for John Cleveland, and everybody comes to the concert and instead Kiss comes out and they save the world and they get medals pinned on them and they're rewarded with an orgy backstage.
So this was kind of like a comic book, in like a picture.
It's called a photo novella.
Photo novella.
It's a comic book made out of photographs.
I remember those. Yeah.
And so the Cream filled in all the captions and the words and everything, and it's very funny and it's very irreverent, and it is online where you can actually see the whole comic book, and it's. Anyway, while we were doing that, it was just sort of an afterthought as we came, because we were down in the subway taking pictures of them, and then there's a picture of them rushing into a phone booth, pulling off their costumes. And we actually had to use a different subway for them to come out pulling, you know, dressed as Kiss after the costume, because I wanted it to run across the page and not have them run in and run back out.
I see.
You know, in the opposite direction. I wanted them to keep going across the page. We actually had to find another subway station with a different phone booth that went the other direction.
That's great.
So we did that. But as we came out of the subway station, I said, I'll just stand here on the corner. Let's get some pictures. And they were just kind of standing around on the corner, 8th Avenue and 23rd Street, for you fans who want to go and do the pilgrimage, southwest corner. And we took a series of pictures there. There's actually some online where you can see some people standing around making jokes about them. Because in those days, Kiss could walk around the sidewalk. They looked like somebody in a Halloween costume. Nobody
even
knew that they were Kiss. And in New York, you have to be more than weird to get attention. So people pretty much ignored them. It's just a bunch of weirdos. You know?
Classic New York, right?
And, yeah. You know, but when we came back to my place, another point about that picture is that Gene and... Ace, I believe, didn't have their own suits, and so they're wearing my suits, which really adds to the picture, especially with Gene, because the suit was far too small for him.
Yeah,
and then he
emphasized
it by folding up the sleeves and rolling up the pants, and he kind of looks like the Hulk, you know, busting out of his clothes because he's so much bigger than the suit.
Right.
You know, recently they did a John Varvatos ad where they look like fashion models because the suits all fit perfectly. The humor in my picture is that it didn't fit at all, and he looks like a monster. You know? And he's wearing my wife's clogs, so he looks like he looks like he's got hoofs instead of feet.
Right.
You know?
Did you get along with those guys?
Yeah. Oh, they're very. I mean, Gene is a laugh a minute. Yeah. You know, and actually ended up friendly with all three of them. Still am today.
That's cool.
Whenever I see them, they're always, you know, really nice.
Well, let's talk about
happy to see me.
Who you're friends with, and I know you're very close to John.
Just to finish part, when they were changing their clothes, we came back to my studio for them to change into their Kiss outfit, and while they were doing that, you know, we come in and they were normal guys wearing these suits with this weird makeup, and I started changing the film and you know, rewinding and reloading the cameras, and at one point I felt this odd presence behind me, and I turned around and Gene had his full costume on, and he suddenly had transformed into a superhero. With the whole outfit, he was no longer this guy I had been joking with, you know, Gene from Queens or whatever, Brooklyn. He was suddenly this monster. And I remember that feeling, like, oh my God, he really is a super monster. He became
the demon.
The character, yeah. The demon.
Which I think kind of all of them did. That was kind of part of the...
Yeah, they really took on the persona of the character. It was more than just makeup. They put on the makeup, put on the clothes, and they were the character.
Yeah.
You know, they really took on that persona.
Yeah, it's unbelievable when you think about that.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
You mentioned being friends with Kiss, and also I know you're very close with John and Yoko in the 70s, which to me is there's a lot to talk about here. And something that I didn't know, but first, just to kind of give a background for it, you mentioned earlier that you had met up with John and Yoko. Were you basically their personal photographer?
Well, I became their personal photographer, which is kind of like official photographer, but you're not exclusive photographer. Mm-hmm. They were a world-class act. Other people took their pictures, but when they wanted a picture, they would call me. I did a couple of unique pictures, like when the picture on John's green card, the identification picture is mine.
Yeah.
When Sean was born and was a month old, they called me to take pictures of the new baby to send to their family, things like that. But also I had access to them in the studio and, you know, all the time visited at home a lot. They were very comfortable with me taking their picture.
How did you come up? How did you guys do the famous New York City picture with John?
Well, John, the art director actually came up with an idea for an album cover, which was a series of pictures just of John's face, and they had to all be the same size because they made they cut the pictures into strips and they put flaps on the album cover. Anybody old enough to remember album covers?
Yeah.
They made
They're
album
back
covers.
They're
you
coming
know,
back now.
I know. And they cut these strips so you could fold a different part of the face over the album cover face, and you could change the eyes or change the mouth and change the expression. And there were actually more pictures on the inner sleeve liner. Albums used to have inner sleeves on them.
With lyrics on
the record. Yeah, yeah, have printing and artwork
and
on
pictures,
it.
Yeah.
And you could pull that out, and you could use that picture with the flaps from the front to create even more variations on the picture. And it was basically a toy. And that was really amusing. They've reissued it over the years.
Which they don't, album is that?
The Walls and Bridges.
Walls and Bridges, okay.
By the time it got to CD, they couldn't make flaps anymore. Mm. There is a Japanese version that's CD size with mini flaps on it. But most of the plastic, you know, what do they call them? Clam box case or whatever.
Jewel box.
They don't have flaps, so they've changed the album cover now that they've reissued it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But the original one had these flaps that would fold over, so we had to do a whole series of pictures just of John's face that were the same size. And he wanted me to do it quickly and easily. The art director had wanted him to go to a famous photographer's studio, and John actually didn't want to spend all afternoon taking the pictures. He felt it was just a series of pictures of his face. How hard could that be?
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me to come over, and it was actually difficult to get them all the exact same size. I set up a Hasselblad on a tripod. I mean, usually I'm much more movable.
Freeform,
I use a 35
yeah.
millimeter and I move around, but this time I put the camera on the tripod and just had him sit there and make all different faces. We did a series of pictures of him making faces with several series, each with different pairs of glasses, and then
you
eventually
see it up here on the wall right there. Is those ones there?
Put all the glasses on.
Yeah,
and that was one of the ones that actually is pretty popular nowadays. I really like the one with all the glasses.
Yeah, that's a famous
because
shot.
In spite
too.
Of you know 5 or 6 pairs of glasses, you can see through them, and you can see John's eye looking through. It was a great day, and I got a great set of pictures of him. And then when we were done, he said, "Well, you know, let's take some more pictures so we have the publicity kit ready." And so we started taking a couple of pictures around the rooftop, and the whole skyline of New York was around us. And the New York City T-shirt is a shirt I used to wear a lot. And they weren't sold by any store or company. They were sold by guys who made them themselves and sold them on the sidewalk in Times Square. And I just liked the graphics of it and the power and simplicity of it. And I used to buy them and, like I say, wear them all the time. And sometimes I would buy some for friends of mine. And one night when I was on the way to visit John in the studio in summer 73, I picked up, these guys were there, and I just picked up a shirt for him. I cut the sleeves off with my buck knife because it gives it a more New York City look. And I gave it to him in the studio. And then a year later when we were on the roof of his apartment and we were taking the pictures, and I said, do you still have that T-shirt I gave you last year? And he knew right where it was. And he had been back and forth to L.A. a couple of times. People have heard about his lost weekend.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a chaotic period in his life. And the fact that he knew where the shirt was and he still had it with him. Because he wasn't back in the Dakota with Yoko yet. He was still in a separate apartment on the east side. But I knew he liked the shirt. And so he put it on and he looked comfortable in it. And we took a series of pictures with the shirt, with the denim jacket on and so on. And we had no idea when we were doing that that would be the most iconic photo taken of John Lennon, because there's an awful lot of pictures taken of him.
Oh, yeah.
So I felt like I won the lottery when that picture got famous, because it is one of the most well-known pictures of John, and there aren't so many pictures of him out there. So
how did that one become so iconic?
Well, people just really like it. And, you know, because we were friends, he was very comfortable and he was very open. He's got the sunglasses on, so he looks like a pop star. But there's something, again, about the power of the New York City statement and the skyline behind him, and him just looking so comfortable, and he looks good, and he's accessible, I mm-hmm. think, in that picture. He's like, you know, because we were having a conversation, and he looks like he's ready to have a conversation with somebody. Those are my ideas. I really don't know why so many people around the world have taken to that picture, but I don't mind.
Yeah, I'm sure, right? I'm sure it's okay for you royalty-wise as well. But I mean, it's so iconic. A, because you say he looks like a rock star. He's wearing a New York City shirt, which is where he lived and basically died. But he's from Liverpool. It's kind of a real international. It really sums up rock and roll for some reason, that picture.
It does, and I don't have specific answers to the reason, but it certainly it resonates with a lot of people around the world. It's all over the world. I've seen it in
everywhere.
There's bootleg T-shirts in Japan, Brazil, Moscow, Europe. Everywhere I've been, I've seen that picture.
What was your relationship with John outside of taking photos? Did you guys hang out sometimes and?
Yeah, sometimes we just go over, watch TV and smoke and talk. And I remember he used to always have a TV on. And one time, because the TV irritates me, I don't really like to watch TV, and I certainly don't like it to have it on if you're not watching it. And we were talking one day, and I said, do you have to have the TV on? It's always flickering, it's so distracting. And he said, well, we could talk if the window was open, couldn't we? And I said, well, yeah. He said, well, that's my window to the world. He was actually the first visitor to this apartment. I lived in the building since 1970, but in 75 we moved up here, and it's about as far as you can get from the front door. It's a little complicated.
Yeah, it takes a little while to get up and down.
You have to actually follow the directions
through a hole, swing across a chasm.
It's kind of like a Rorschach text. Did they listen to the doorman's directions or not? How long is it going to take? And actually, when I was moving upstairs here from the other apartment we had, which was the first apartment, was right next to the front door. And John and Yoko lived around the corner on Bank Street, literally half a block away. And sometimes they would come to visit. I had a videotape machine in the early days, and they had one, but they'd given it to some Indian tribe. And so when somebody would send them a tape, they'd come over to my house to watch it. And other times they came by. When they played on the Jerry Lewis Telethon, we recorded it. And in those days, there was no way to set a recorder. It was very rare that somebody could record a show at all, but we happen to have not just a videotape machine, but a monitor that you could record off of. And so after the telethon, they came down to our house to watch it, and with the Elvis Memories and some Hells Angels and a whole bunch of people. It was quite a party. So anyway, John knew where that apartment was, and it was easy. But he called me the weekend I was moving up to this new apartment, and I told him I was in the darkroom finishing some pictures, and he said that he wanted to meet him. He wanted me to meet him because Harry Nilsson was in town. And John hadn't been drinking since he had come back from L.A., hadn't really been out, but Harry was in town. He said, I got to go out. It's Harry's here, And I knew all the doormen and club owners, so he wanted me to come along and, kind of smooth things out. So I went to meet him at the first place. By the time I got there, they had just left. Because whenever they got somewhere, they were so popular that within 20 minutes, there was such a crowd around him, he'd have to leave. And they went uptown to Tracks, and I went up there, and they had just left. And they went over to JP's, and I went over there, and I just missed them. And I thought, I can't chase them around all night, forget this. And I came home Friday night, and they were out all weekend. And Sunday afternoon, John called me, and he said he was in the neighborhood. And could he stop by before he went home? He wanted just to have a cup of coffee and kind of come down a bit. And I said, sure. I said, but I moved to a new apartment, so have the doorman buzz me when you get here, and I'll come down and get you to show you how to get up here. So about a half hour or so goes by, and I'm thinking he should have been here already. And I was walking across the apartment to buzz back to the doorman and see if some weird English guy had shown up. And John came breezing into the apartment, and he said, man, you got some weird neighbors. And you see, because this apartment, this building, the entire building is artist residence. So everybody is some kind of an artist, all different kinds, but there's some kind of artist. So he was ringing doorbells, trying to find my apartment. And this is like middle of July, a summer afternoon on a Sunday afternoon, and everybody's an artist, and suddenly John Lennon is standing at your door at 4 o'clock on a Sunday. And so everybody's saying, oh, let me read you my poem, let me show you my dance, I just made a new painting, I just wrote a song. Everybody had something to say to him, So I'm kind of well known in the building ever since then.
For that. There's and what I was going to bring up earlier is I just read a book called Man on the Run. It's about McCartney in the 70s. And talked, which I didn't realize how much that John and Paul actually had talked to each other and kind of hung out and that sort of thing. And there's a story in there about you being at John's or something when Paul showed up.
Yeah. Well, I was often at the apartment, like I say, hanging out, watching TV.
This is the Dakota?
At the Dakota apartment. And nobody gets into the Dakota apartments without being announced. Like it just wouldn't happen if somebody would ring your doorbell, without the there's like two or three layers of doormen downstairs, you know, the people at security that people have to get through. So we're sitting there one night in early December, and suddenly the doorbell rang. And John and Yoko were under the deportation hearing. The U.S. government was trying to throw them out. And the government had shown up at their apartment here on Bank Street one night just to escort them to the airport. And so the fact that somebody was at the door without being announced made John and Yoko extremely nervous. And, you know, who could that possibly be? And they had no idea. And I went out to open the doors to find out. And there was a double door. So I opened the inner door, and I heard what sounded like children singing Christmas carols. You know, we wish you a Merry Christmas, like that. And I yelled back, like, don't be nervous, it's just some kids with Christmas carols. And I opened the outer door, and it was Paul and Linda singing Christmas carols.
That's great.
So they came breezing in. I said, I think you want to see the guys in the bedroom there. And because John and Yoko spent most of their time sitting on their bed. That's where they would meet people. That's where they would
really
eat things. Yeah, they spent a lot of time sitting in bed. That really nice bed. and so we went in there, and seeing them greeting each other, it was like old friends happy to see each other. You know, there might have been animosity between lawyers, but not between the Beatles, as far as I saw. I know John was in touch with Ringo all the time, in touch with George. They stopped working together, but they didn't stop being friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed very happy to see each other. Paul had just recently been refused admission into Japan because he had a prior arrest for a little bit of marijuana. And we talked about that a bit. And he was talking about how much he wanted to go back to Japan. And basically we had English tea, you know, with milk and a little sugar, the way English people do. and it seemed like a very friendly meeting. Yoko and Linda were getting along like friends. And it seemed like a really pleasant meeting. I do remember a couple of years later, Paul finally got permission to go to Japan, and he went in, and they discovered 8 ounces of pot on the top of his suitcase. I remember asking John, like, why would he do that? Like, he had been refused admission for having a tiny bit, and he comes in from Hawaii with 8 ounces on the top of his suitcase, you know? Like, you're traveling with 25, 30 people. Couldn't there be, like, one extra pink suitcase? Nobody knows whose it is, you know?
Yeah.
And John said, well, as a Beatle, it never occurred to him that he would be searched. It just never happened. They always got such special VIP treatment. They were just whisked through airports. They never, ever, you know, would imagine that they could be searched. And I thought that was kind of ironic.
Very interesting, right? Yeah, when you think about how big that band was and how well treated they were.
Yeah.
Did he talk about Beatles stuff a lot?
Not a lot. I mean, there were a couple of things I remember him saying. One of the last conversations we had, he was very happy that people were reviewing Yoko Ono's contributions to the Double Fantasy album. He was really thrilled that people seemed to really like her work. And so they were in the studio making a new song that Yoko had just written, Walking on Thin Ice. And while they were mixing it, at one point there was some delay in the taping, and we sat on the floor and talked for quite a while. And one of the things he told me then was that he was very proud to have been the leader of the best band in the world, the Beatles. You know, that he was aware that it was considered the best band in the world. He certainly thought it was. And he was very proud to be, you know, considered the leader of that. And he also said, I've had the fortune, you know, great fortune as a producer to work with two of the best artists in the world, Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono. And hearing that in the same sentence, I knew that there might be a lot of people in the world who didn't understand him, but I did understand him, and I understood that as much as he admired Paul, he admired Yoko, and he was, you know, very, you know, blessed to be working with both of them.
Deep respect for Yoko as an artist.
Listen to anything he says, and it's always, you know, about how much he respects Yoko, how much he listens to Yoko, how much he learned and was inspired by Yoko.
Right.
I've never met anybody who has met Yoko who didn't like her. I've met a lot of people who haven't met her.
Who don't like her.
Who don't like her because of what they hear in the press.
Yeah.
She's had her art exhibits around the world. Always great success with that. She just finally had one here in New York at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. They were making a big deal about how they finally recognized Yoko, not taking into account that she has had countless exhibits in museums around the world.
For 50
years.
Of course,
MoMA has, you know, a bit of an ego about themselves. But they did finally recognize her, and she had a very big, very successful exhibit there. So it's only like 40 years later, you know, 50 years later yeah. since she made the work that people are finally waking up to what it is and what it means and how amazing, how amazingly simple it is and at the same time how powerful it is.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody wants to find out about Yoko, they should, you know, see her work like John did. You know, if they want to hear how John felt about Yoko, they should read the interviews.
Mm-hmm.
He may have been with other women at times, but he always admired Yoko, and he always, you know, he only wrote songs about Yoko. He didn't write songs about other women.
Yeah.
You know, their relationship is one for the ages. You know, John used to say that John Yoko was one word. And for many people, it is.
He believed, you know? Yeah. Do you think, and this is just a guessing game or fantasy, but had John not passed away when he did, do you think the Beatles would have ever done something again?
Well, one never knows. Yeah. Do one. You know, what the future could hold. There certainly are a lot of bands that are getting back together that you never expected. You know,
that's true.
I mean, from, you know, some of the bigger bands, you know, Aerosmith broke up. They came back together.
The Police.
The New York Dolls. I mean, the New York Dolls broke up for 30 years. They came back together. The Police are touring. Yeah. You look around, like half the bands that are touring now are bands, you know, that broke up in the 70s. The Rolling Stones were smart. They never broke up.
Yeah.
They just didn't work together for 8 years.
You
know? And did solo projects, but they never said they broke up.
Did you take a lot of shots with the Stones?
Yes, over the years, quite a bit. I actually have a book that came out on Genesis, 25 years of the Rolling Stones.
Wow, so you work with them quite
Crossfire Hurricane
as well. That was Crossfire Hurricane was your book.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
How was the dynamics taking shots at those guys?
They're always fun and they know what they're doing. You know, it makes it very easy. I haven't done a lot of personal sessions, but I did an at-home session with Ronnie Wood once. I've seen Keith at a lot of parties and events and things. We get along pretty well. He's the coolest guy going, you know.
He is, right?
The Rolling Stones are the best looking band. If you want to look like a rock and roll band, you have to know what the Rolling Stones look like.
As far as
haircut and attitude, you know, rock and roll is more than just music. It's haircut and attitude. Because for me, rock and roll is not just about the beat, it's about the freedom. I think that rock and roll is the freedom to express yourself very loudly. And the Rolling Stones certainly are the best example of that. And all the bands that have come since, you know.
When you talk about attitude, I know, you know, you mentioned you worked a lot with the Stones and with John and Yoko and with Kiss, but then suddenly when the punk scene exploded in the mid-70s, late-70s, you were right involved with those bands as well.
Well, like I say, in my life, one thing leads to another. It was actually interesting that I met the New York Dolls because, again, through the connection with John and Yoko, they had the Elephant's Memory band as a backup band, and the Elephant's Memory were managed by Lieber and Krebs. And when I went to the office, I was working on an album cover for Elephant's Memory. They said, "You got to see this other band that we manage, the New York Dolls." And so I ended up going down to Mercer Arts Center and seeing the Dolls, being totally blown away, starting to work with them, and they becoming very good friends with them. They're like family to me.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of years later, when they were breaking up, Malcolm McLaren came to town with some clothes that he had made for them. And, you know, they credit Malcolm as managing the Dolls, but he didn't really manage them. But he did manage to resurrect them from the ashes that they were about to fall into and save their lives. He got Arthur into a rehab. He got Jerry and Johnny into rehabs. Basically, because he wanted them to play concerts and wear his clothes. So he got them to play a couple of shows. But they were really falling apart, and that didn't really work. And he went back to England, bringing Sylvain's equipment with him. And Sylvain from the Dolls was going to start a new band with Malcolm in England. And Malcolm started getting some backup guys, you know, the rest of the band together. He got Steve Jones and, you know, Paul Cook and Glenn Matlock. And Syl was supposed to come. I played a little role in there since I had some contacts in Japan and the Dolls were, David and Syl were totally broke. A promoter who wanted to bring the Dolls to Japan said that if they got another couple of guys together, they could come to Japan as the Dolls. So David and Sylvain went to Japan and Malcolm got tired of waiting and he got this other guy called Johnny Rotten. And that became the Sex Pistols instead of Sylvain's band.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that could have been Syl's band.
So that they wanted that to be kind of some of the dudes from the Dolls.
Yeah, I don't know how things would have worked out again. You know, who knows what the future could have been. But when I went to England a year later, Malcolm had this band, the Sex Pistols, and Malcolm was the only person I knew in England besides the editor of the Melody Maker, who I actually had never met, but I'd worked with. So I called him up. I had dinner with the editor, and Malcolm got me a place to stay, and he took me to a place called Club Louise, which was kind of like the back room of Max's for the punk scene in England. In this one little club, I met the Sex Pistols, the Clash, Susie and the Banshees, Billy Idol, Marco Peroni, Caroline Coon, and John Savage, the journalists who were writing up the punk scene. And I basically just kind of met everybody in one night.
All the heads of state, right?
Yeah, yeah, and all of that was from Malcolm, who I met through the Dolls, who I met through John and Yoko.
One thing leads to another. Who was your favorite of, of all those punk bands?
I don't have lists, because when you've been back and forth on a bus, across America with the Clash a couple of times, I went on the Sex Pistols bus. I've seen a lot of those bands play. I saw people like X-Ray Specs in a pub in England, when they were starting out, and it's hard to list who's number one or who's number two, Although I will say that the Sex Pistols make people scream with rage, but the Clash gave people the reasons. They say that the Sex Pistols look back in anger and the Clash look to the future with hope. So I think that I'm one of those people who thinks that the Clash were the only band that really mattered.
Because the Clash were really huge in America, which people...
Yeah, they broke out and had hits, and... it's interesting, at one point when they were selling out, all their concerts were selling out, and one of the journalists said, to Mick Jones, the Clash was having a press conference, and he said, you've been accused of selling out, how do you answer that? And he said, well, when you schedule a concert, and you print up a certain number of tickets, and then when people have bought all the tickets, you've sold out.
We sell out every night.
And they sell out every night, and they were great, and they never had a show that wasn't sold out.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, right from the beginning.
I don't really know a lot about Joe Strummer. Kind of a mysterious guy.
He used to sleep on his couch.
On this couch right here. How many guys have slept on this couch?
A few. Johansson.
Strummer.
John's had tea here. Actually, it's a new couch, but it's in the
this
same place
area.
As the old couch. Eventually, that old couch had to go.
I'm sure.
But yeah, they slept right here in this room.
Strummer, was he a pretty intricate guy? Was he a cool guy, funny guy?
He was very funny and very deep, thoughtful guy. Like, he'd always go, I've been thinking. And then he'd come up with things like, I found a dime today, and I put it in my pocket, and I thought it would be my lucky dime. But then when I took it out, there was two dimes, and I don't know which one was the lucky one. And I'd have to say things like, well, you found two dimes instead of one. I think you had your luck already. You don't get a lot of luck with a dime. So we'd have conversations like that. But whenever he would say, I've been thinking, something really interesting would come out. I remember one of his trips to New York. He was really into photography. He was into photography. A number of his friends were photographers. He really liked the process, and he liked the way you could create different things through photography. And one trip he was here, he was fascinated with the reflections in hubcaps. And every time he saw a shiny hubcap, like we're walking around the city, he would get down and start taking pictures of the city reflected in the hubcap.
Wow.
We had a lot of fun together. My wife and I used to always tell each other, though, that when you go out to dinner with Joe Strummer, we'd remind each other, you got your sunglasses? Like, we'd have to make sure we brought our sunglasses. Because if you go out to dinner with Joe, you'd end up going somewhere else and then somewhere else. And when you walk out of a bar at 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, you need your sunglasses. We made the mistake of forgetting them once when we went out with him in Chicago, and at 8 in the morning, it was one of those nights when it snowed all night and then the sun came out in the morning.
Yeah.
On the bright white snow, and we didn't have our sunglasses. And after that, we never forgot to bring them.
Lesson learned.
Joe would keep you out all night. And a great thing about Joe was that he didn't just talk to people like a pop star. A lot of pop stars talk about themselves and what they did. Joe would listen to people. And all kinds of people. And I remember, he'd come to, New York, and we knew some of the locals, and we'd go, that guy's a jerk. Why do you want to talk to him? He goes, no, he's fascinating. He comes from Texas. Listen to his stories. And we're like, oh, God, how long is this going to take? But Joe was always listening to anybody who would talk to him. He stayed up till dawn most nights, just talking and listening, having conversations with people.
Did you take a lot of live photos as well?
Yeah, most of the time. I would say more than half of my photos are live photos.
So who were some of your favorite bands to take shots of? because, you know,
live again, I don't really make lists because I lived with a band called the Glitter House in the 60s, and then they got a deal. Bob Crewe, actually, the famous producer, produced their record. They did the vocals for Barbarella.
Okay.
He liked them. He used them for that, and then he did an album with them, and they were really fun to be with. But then I met Ike and Tina Turner, and there's nobody on stage more amazing than Tina Turner. But through Ike and Tina, I met some publicists and a few more people in record companies, and I got hired to photograph Elton John when he first came to New York. And I remember thinking, like, oh, you're a piano player. How do you take a good picture of a piano player? They got that big box in front of them. Right. It's hard to even see their fingers on the keys. Well, Elton John jumps on top of the piano. He plays horizontal with his feet out in the air, you know, like he's flying. I mean, he's really exciting. Even for a piano player, right, you know, right. He turns it into a real show. But then I met the New York Dolls, and they do a really amazing show. I mean, you can't take your eyes off them. They were like a train wreck. You know, they were so bad. They were good. They were so good. They were bad. You know, it's like love them or hate them.
Yeah.
When the Dolls would come out on stage and start playing, as they started playing, the audience would jump up in the air, start screaming, and bump into each other because half the people were running towards the stage and half the people were running towards the door. You know. But then, of course, the Clash were... I've never seen them do a bad show. The Sex Pistols were interesting in a different way because the whole room was chaos and a riot and people throwing things in both directions. Mm-hmm. People would throw things at the band. The band would throw it back. It was pretty much...
Could they play at all, Sex Pistols?
Watching Debbie Harry play is something I could do all night, every night.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Debbie's always real easy to watch, and the music was great, and she was funny.
So what are you looking for?
How do you make a list, you know, who's best? You know what I mean?
It's energy that you're looking for, though,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I like to see passion and feeling, and in fact, in my photos, I like to capture the passion and the feeling rather than just the facts. Like, to me, it's not so important whether the guy is wearing a green shirt and big boots. It's like, how does he feel? What's he putting out? You know, how does the audience react to what he's doing? And because I'm a fan and because I react to what they're doing, I know when to take the picture. I know when that moment comes, that everything comes together and you really capture the feeling of what's going on and the energy of what's going on and the freedom of what's going on and not just, you know, the fact of here's these five guys on this stage tonight.
Sure. So when you say, I mean, things have changed over the years as far as we were laughing about LPs and albums and all this sort of thing, but also the role of a photographer as well. When you're talking about, you know, the New York City John Lennon picture, for example, and that goes all around the world, is this like your copywritten picture that you get royalties
for? Well, it's my copywritten picture, and yes, I do get royalties sometimes when people don't rip it off and not pay me.
Right.
You know, with the internet generation, people don't seem to understand what copyright means, that you're supposed to pay for somebody's work. It's similar to the music, that people just feel, if there's music in the world, why can't I just have it?
Yeah.
You know, you really have to pay somebody. I mean, how hard can it be to write a song? You're just writing a couple of words. You're singing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, musicians, they're just playing. Why do you think they call it play?
Mm-hmm.
Is it really that hard? You know, and why shouldn't we just have it free? And it's the same thing with photographs. People see something, they think, well, I'm looking at it. Looking at it for free, why can't I just take it
a screenshot and
put it somewhere else? You make a screenshot, you put it on a t-shirt, you put it on a poster. You know, I've seen my pictures bootlegged around the world. And in fact, sometimes when I see a wall of bootlegs, I'm kind of pissed if I don't have one up there. Like, wait, what about me? You know,
like, am I good enough to get stolen too?
Well, because bootleggers can steal anything they want.
Right.
And so when they choose to steal mine so consistently, it is kind of a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing you can do. You know, no bootlegger ever paid me a dime. You know, people who steal from the act steal from me too.
Mm-hmm.
I do occasionally have legitimate deals where people pay for pictures, which is fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it does get around a lot. Nowadays, it's so easy to share things on the internet.
It's the same as you mentioned, the music itself.
Yeah.
Or, you know, videos or movies or whatever. Just gone. Take it if you want it. You know?
Yeah, people just send it around freely, sharing everything, and it does cut into your income.
How does that, let's say now, you know, here we are in 2015, and you have all these great experiences and all these amazing, you know, this track record. Do you still work quite frequently? There's still a lot of bands that'll bring you to take pictures?
No.
Okay.
No.
I'm just wondering.
In fact, so many people take their own pictures. You know, everybody loves the picture that their girlfriend takes or the manager takes or, you know, some fan takes and sends in. My own son is a singer-songwriter, and I've taken a series of really nice pictures that he liked. At first, actually, he didn't have me take any pictures because he wanted to make it on his own and didn't want my help. And then eventually I kind of felt good that he actually said, you know, okay, Dad, you know, could you take some pictures for me? And I did a nice series of pictures, and he was going to use them to promote his album. And then he sent me an email and said that his daughter, Jasmine, my granddaughter, who was 8 years old at the time, had taken a really nice picture of him, and he was going to use that one instead. And I couldn't argue with him because the picture was really good.
Yeah.
And she had done it on purpose. She'd taken a series of like a dozen pictures until she got it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew because she was, you know, creating this and done it on purpose that it was a good thing. And but that happens frequently, so I don't really pursue that kind of work anymore. It's also more difficult for me being so well known that if I'm taking pictures of a band and the drummer's girlfriend is taking a picture of me while I'm taking a picture of them, it doesn't set up the kind of relaxed situation I usually like. And also
right.
because people kind of expect that every twitch of my finger is an iconic moment, they're not into working it as, you know, like they used to be. You know, it used to be kind of a joint thing where we would, you know, create the picture together.
Right.
And now they kind of figure if they just stand there, I'll make it happen.
Yeah, it's
not
group.
The way it works, you know.
Thing, yeah.
So there's a lot of pressure on me to, you know, come up with things like that. And I'm doing really well selling my old pictures and having exhibitions and making books, and that's why I do interviews like this. So
right.
I spend more time. You know,
what other pictures do you have? You mentioned we know the Lennon with the glasses. I had no idea that was yours.
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously we know the New York City. We know the Kiss Dressed to Kill. Is there other ones that if you say?
Well, there's Led Zeppelin standing in front of the airplane. Is a pretty well known picture.
Wow. Okay.
It kind of sums up the excess of the 70s.
Yeah.
There's a picture of Debbie Harry in a tiger dress. It's actually, nowadays, there's one of her I took at Coney Island that seems to be getting around quite a bit. But there's loads of pictures out there. A lot of pictures of The Clash. One of the best live pictures I ever did is a really powerful picture of The Clash. It's on the cover of my book. Also on the cover of the... Well, there's a different picture. I did a whole book of pictures of The Clash that's out there. Which just was reissued this year, The Clash, photographs by Bob Gruen. There's a book I did of all my pictures of the New York Dolls. Is still available in print. There's a book I did last spring that's just came out called See Here Yoko, a book that we did as a birthday present for Yoko after more than 40 years of working with Yoko. She was turning 80 2 years ago, and myself with a friend of mine who's a DJ who's been interviewing Yoko for over 25 years, we took quotes from her interviews and combined them with my photos. And we made a one-off book where nowadays you can upload pictures through a program online,
mm-hmm.
and they send you back a nicely printed hardcover book. And so we did that as a one-off, as a gift for Yoko, and really picked all the pictures as a gift for her. A lot of them very personal, pictures of her at home with Sean, pictures of her traveling, shopping, a lot of memorable events on tour and different events that she you know sponsored. And she liked the book so much she asked us to publish it.
Oh.
So it came out last spring, fortunately just in time to be sold at her exhibit at MoMA. And it's called See Here Yoko, and that's the newest one that I've put together.
So you still have a relationship with Yoko?
Yeah,
constantly. You see her sometimes?
Actually, next week she's doing a peace circle in Central Park. I expect to see her there.
That's great, man. So there's still a lot of people that you worked with in the 70s that you still have relationships with?
Yeah. Yeah, quite a few. Most of them. I mean, a lot of people I meet once and you take a photo and that was it and I never met them again. Other people I met several times and over years became friends with and I'm still friends with today. Certainly Debbie Harry and, you know, the New York Dolls that are still alive.
Johansson,
and,
right?
Last year at my birthday party, Alice Cooper came and sang 18.
Really?
Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day came and sang a couple songs.
Have you worked with Green Day as well?
I've been working with Green Day about 18 years now. I'm waiting another 2 years. I plan to put out a book when it's 20 years of Green Day.
So that's kind of a modern band that you worked with then,
and,
too. So,
yeah, and I still work with them. I mean, I do take pictures of the bands when it's a comfortable situation, when I'm not limited to just three songs in front of the stage taking the same picture that everybody else is taking.
Yeah, because that's kind of the rule, right? Three songs at first.
Well, yeah, nowadays you go out and you take three songs and you have to beg for permission for 3 months to get to those three songs. And then you have the same photos that the other 20 people who got in there have. And it's uploaded before the first song is over. There's 3,000 kids in the audience taking pictures, and they upload the picture by before the first song is done. It's already internationally, you know, shown and seen. It's not really something in my, you know, the way I used to work, where you photograph a concert and then you go home and you develop the pictures, and a couple of days later you send them out, and a week or two later they're published. That world doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. So I don't try to compete with, you know, people who can upload a picture in 14 seconds, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But people like Green Day, I just have fun with them, and I just enjoy working with them. They enjoy having their picture taken, and I have complete access with them, so I work with them. Another new group that I work with, actually, I could recommend, the Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
That's Strypes. They're a band from Ireland. They're about 17 years old now. They're one of the best bands I've seen in years. It's kind of like seeing the Yardbirds or the Animals when they were 16 or 17. Mm-hmm.
Were you there
because,
to see them?
They're not copying anybody. They have the same roots, but they're unique and just really have the energy and power that so many bands lack. You know?
Do you have a favorite band just for you personally?
Be hard to pick a favorite because I have a lot of favorites. You know, that's what it is, like 5,000 albums and
I'm just looking at surrounded by
CDs,
books and, all over the place. And
I mean, on my phone, I got 3,500 songs and I like them all.
Yeah.
So I don't really have, you know, I can't make lists of my. Well, they once asked me to make a list of top 10 favorite albums, and I had like 1A, 1B, 1C. My list went to like 25. I think they printed about 17 and they ran out of space.
What were some of the albums that were in there?
Miles Davis, Sketches of Spain, or Kind of Blue, Roland Kirk, any one of them, certainly The Clash, you know, Sandinista. I can Tina Turner Live in Paris. These are just off the top of my head that I remember. Otis Redding, Live at Monterey. He was great. I don't know.
A wide selection.
Yeah, I mean, you turn on my iPod and it's like the voice of God, you know. It's, you know, everybody from Jack Kerouac to The Stripes, you know.
Every in between. Final question, is there, when you think about your pictures, is there one picture that, I know you don't like making lists, but is there a picture that stands out to you as being like, wow, this one's my favorite?
Well, no, I don't have a favorite, because like you say, I have lots of favorites, you know. Fortunately, I have a lot of good ones. But, you know, up near the top would be the picture of John Lennon at the Statue of Liberty, which I like a lot because of what it says, because it says a lot about personal freedom. Because I think a lot of people see John Lennon as a symbol of personal freedom, similar to the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the few pictures I actually thought up in advance and suggested to him that we go out there and make that picture on purpose. And so that one, you know, that I created, I really like. There's another one that was kind of by accident, but an accident that happened on purpose because I tried to do something like that. I took a picture of Tina Turner as she was dancing off the stage. A strobe light was flashing, and I thought if I opened my camera to 1 second, I would catch several of the flashes and see what happened. And I took four or five pictures like that, and about the other four aren't very good, but one picture just captures five images of Tina perfectly that, you know, kind of sum up the power and the fury and the grace and the energy that is Tina Turner.
Right, energy being
and,
the keyword.
And it takes more than one picture to capture Tina Turner, but this is one picture that has five images.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really like that one a lot, and that one helped me a lot in my early career as well. It would help me to meet Ike and Tina, and then that led to meeting all kinds of other people.
Do you miss John Lennon?
I miss him every day, but I also miss, you know, Joe Strummer. I miss Johnny Thunders. I miss a lot of people.
A lot of icons, man. And you're one of them, Bob. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks to Bob Gruen for having me up to his house, to his studio in New York. It's the same place that John Lennon used to visit, just not on the same couch. But his place was just, it was like a rock and roll museum, man. It had all of these prints on the wall and thousands of albums. And it's like you walk in there, like, this is the 70s. He had so many great pictures of John Lennon. Like I said, the iconic New York City t-shirt. He had some great shots of Blondie, some shots of the Stones, Mick and Keith on stage live, some cool stuff from Green Day. He had this other great shot of John Lennon with six pairs of sunglasses on. If you Google John Lennon sunglasses picture, you'll see that. Bob and John were friends, and you can always tell that with the work that they did together. John was always more open in those classic Bob Gruen photographs. But what a great guest to have on the show. I had to track him down, and he was very agreeable, and I'd never met him before and never seen him since. He reminded me a lot of my Stuart Copeland interview in the fact that I don't know if I'll ever see him again, but I had that really cool moment of time with him. So you want to check out more of Bob's incredible pictures, go to bobgruen.com. That last name is spelled G-R-U-E-N, bobgruen.com. Bob's also got some great photography books out. See Here Yoko, which is a book he did with Yoko Ono. Bob Gruen's Rock Scene, that's spelled S-E-E-N. The Clash, photographs by Bob Gruen. And John Lennon, The New York Years. That one is amazing. I checked that one out at Bob's house. You want to go look at it. Go to Amazon and pick it up. And if you go to Amazon, please use the Talk is Jericho Amazon links, and you can support the show and Bob Gruen, who deserves it, with one tap of your finger, right? You know the drill. You find the Talk is Jericho Amazon links by going to podcast1.com, clicking on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hitting the Talk is Jericho button. I got those links for the USA, the UK, the Canada, Every time you use the Talk is Jericho Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage of the show to help us cover production costs. No hidden fees or extra charges. You just buy anything you want on Amazon, and you get the best prices too. So go to podcast1.com, click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit that Talk is Jericho button, okay? Great sponsors are all there: TrueCar, Geico, Denso Iridium, TT Spark Plugs, and of course, DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho to get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga app. And hey, I've been reading the comments at iTunes. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for leaving your 5-star reviews. Thanks for the feedback. I'm glad you guys like the diversity of the show. It's never going to change. I got a lot of really weird, outside-the-box, riveting shows coming up. So please, if you like this show, give them all a chance. And if you haven't gone on iTunes and given us a comment or subscribe, please go do that now. Thanks to Marta Felis, Basketball, DJ88, Y2 Jessica, Matt Moss, Rob G45, Owens11B, Tyler Jackson 3, Eric336. Eric, thanks for the suggestion to get some of the guys together to talk about Metallica. Seems like the crew cast really went well. We've got another band planned, but I do want to do a Metallica cast, I guess you'd say. I'll see what I can do. And thanks for you guys once again for subscribing and for all the great comments. And just a quick note about Daniel Bryan. He retired this week. And I know some people are thinking, oh, it's just a big angle. This is not an angle. It's very real. And I think we can breathe a sigh of relief. As much as it sucks that he can never wrestle again, let's be thankful that he got out with his wits about him. I know there's a lot of speculation over the last few months over, you know, that the WWE was holding Daniel Bryan back and everyone was clearing him except for the WWE doctor. We should thank the WWE and their doctors for holding out on this, because they were right. Daniel went on ESPN this week and said that he's had some post-concussion seizures, and he actually has a lesion on his brain caused by a concussion. That is serious, serious stuff. You know, you talk about the horrible tragedy with Chris Benoit, the movie Concussion, all the work that Chris Nowinski has done. We know that this is real. We know it can be very, very damaging to have a concussion. And at 34 years old, the fact that Brian walked away and can have a normal life and hopefully no more symptoms, to me, means more than any 5-star matches that he can have. So if you haven't seen his final speech on Raw, you got to track it down. It was just riveting, unbelievably emotional, and a great piece of work. A great way to send off who, in my opinion, one of the greatest of all times. We only worked together twice, I believe. His very first match in WWE was with me when he was back in the early days of NXT, and then we had another match, a singles match on Raw one time. If we had any others, I don't remember them. But actually, my favorite thing I ever did with Daniel Bryan was this promo that we did, where it ends up with him chanting yes and me chanting ever again. I think
think there's actually a mashup of it. Yes, ever. Yes, ever again. Yes, ever again. Yes, ever again. Something like that. It was really, really funny. You might want to go check that out too. So thanks for everything that Brian Danielson did. I had a chance to talk with him in Seattle for about 10, 15 minutes. I tracked him down. He's kind of hiding out in a room. And I was like, oh, this is how you get your own dressing room. Just retire. So it was cool to talk to him. And he's been on Talk Is Jericho a couple times now. And maybe in the future I'll have him on again to discuss his post-concussion life. But like I said, happy trails to Brian Danielson. Much respect. One of my all-time favorites. And one of my new favorites, AJ Styles. If you didn't see the match we had on SmackDown last night, whoo! It was a barn burner, man. Instant classic. 4.5 stars out of 5, if I do say so myself. And will there be more matches? Well, you just never know. Just keep watching. Keep enjoying what we're doing. Keep on keeping on, as I always say. And thanks for listening today. And keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And that's it. That's been a great week on Talk Is Jericho, and the hits keep on coming. And next week, we've actually got a very heavy show. And if you guys remember the Station nightclub fire that happened about 12 years ago, the huge fire in Providence, Rhode Island, that burned down a club that Great White was playing in, and 100 people in that club passed away. It's a terrible story. I got Mike Riccardi, who actually survived that fire. He was inside the Station nightclub when it went up in flames, and in about 90 seconds he was able to escape as the entire place went up like a tinderbox. And his best friend who was with him did not make it out. His best friend passed away. And I've got the whole riveting story from Mike Riccardi, who was in the Station nightclub. We're going to go through all of the evidence as to what happened in this horrible tragedy, one of the worst in American history, where 100 people passed away. Mike wrote a book called Just a Thought Away, a true story of friendship, tragedy, and the will to live. And we're going to talk about that as well. So it's going to be a little bit different, but what a story it is. What a story it is. And it's going to be here next Wednesday. So we'll see you then. Thank you so much for listening. You guys be cool. Stay hard. Stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. And yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.